the show that's focused on investing strategies for today's needs and tomorrow's goals. This is Bucket Strategy Investing, presented by the Wealth Advisors at Lucia Capital Group. Now, here are Johnny Dean and Rick the Professor Plum.
Yeah, time again. Welcome back to the program. Johnny Dean, Professor Rick Plum, once again. It is the Bucket Strategy Investing Program. A lot of stuff to talk about this hour. We got strategy, we got questions, we got answers for you. And this is what we do every day on this program. Professor Rick Plum here with me again, helping out. We got the strategy portion of the show. And of course, your chance to take part in the discussion is right now. I would suggest you do that. Take advantage of the years and years of experience and the knowledge that we've got here in the studio. And listen, all you got to do is just give us a call. Give us a call. We'll answer your questions. And we'll also get to your emails. Everything. Anything you got for us, you give us a call. We do have several lines open right now. In fact, they're all open. So pick up your phone. You give us a call. Our number is 877-PLANNER, 877-752-6637, PLANNER. And I know you got some email questions, comments, concerns, whatever it is. You can send them to us. Our website is wealthed.com. You go there. You have the Find Your Answer link near the top of the page. We'll answer them here on the show. Got several last hour, too. We didn't get to everybody's. I apologize. We will get to them in just a couple of moments. Now, Professor Rick Plum, our certified financial planner, here with us again from Lucia Capital Group. You got that money question, or if you want a bucket strategy put together just for you, you reach Rick Plum or any of the advisors that we've got there at Lucia Capital Group, 800-644-1150. That's the off-air number. They're here to help you out with anything that you might need. Off-air, again, the number 800-644-1150. Talk to any of the Nationwide Brain Trust advisors about your retirement plan, about your bucket strategy. On the air, you reach us, 877-PLANNER, P-L-A-N-N-E-R. We do have lines open right now, so any question, concern, comment you have, you give us a call. We will talk to you for the next hour or so, a little bit less. Now, speaking of which, Professor Plum, we had a discussion last week, I think it was sometime, that had to do with something that's known as a structured note, a buffered, what would you call it?
A midterm investment.
A midterm investment. Now, see, I haven't heard that one. Midterm investment.
That's what it's designed to be. It's designed to help you get a little bit better rate of return than we can get on fixed guaranteed investments, but not take the entire volatility of the market. And so that's what we're trying to do. Now, fixed index annuities try to do that, but right now, in recent history, the cap rates, the upside potential has been somewhat limited. So to give you a little more on the upside, they've created these structured notes, and what they do is they say the cap rates are going to be expanded quite a bit. So depending upon whether it's a 1, 3, 5 year holding period, mm-hmm. the cap rates may be actually somewhat reasonable. You won't get 100% of the market in years like 2013, where the market was up just crazy amounts. But they're very attractive on the upside with some cap there. But what happens on the downside is if we have a year like this year, where the market's down 10%, there's a safety net on the bottom side, a buffer they call it. And so if the market's in it, you can pick different buffers. Obviously, the larger the safety net, the less the upside potential. The smaller the safety net, the more the upside potential. If you want to take the safety net off all the way and you just invest in the market, you get the entire upside of the market,
but you also
get the entire downside.
Exactly.
So if you want to put some guardrails on this to give yourself some help on the downside, they can put these buffers in place. The buffer could be 10, 15, 20%, 25, 30%. But let's say that it's a 10% buffer, just hypothetically speaking here. We have a 10% buffer. If the market goes down over the measuring period, it could be 1 year, 2 year, 3 year, 4 year, 5 year measuring period. If it from point A to point B, if the market's down less than the buffer, you lose nothing.
So let's say the market goes down 6% 1 year and I have a 10% buffer. I'm not down 6%.
No, you're zero.
I'm at zero.
And this goes back to what is it that you're actually investing in? You're investing in a note. You're investing in something that pays interest. The interest, similar to a fixed index annuity, but dissimilar because there's no guarantee, it pays interest based on the movement of an index. And the indexes can be very broad. It can be a basket of stocks. It can be all kinds of things. It can be interest rates, for that matter. So you have to understand what you're basing your potential rate of return on. So if the index over the measuring period is positive, you get the positive result up to the cap. If it's negative, you do not share in the negativity equal to the buffer. But let's take one like the Dow Jones or something of that nature. It's currently down about 14% from its high of last year. And if we looked at a 10% buffer, and it was on a one-year basis from the point where you started to today, and you were and the index was down 14%, and you had a 10% basically get out of jail free card, well, the other 4% is still yours. So you do have that risk that from point A to point B, if it goes down more than the buffer, you would experience that excess loss.
Okay, if you have a 10% buffer, the market's down 14. Mm-hmm. You're not down 14.
If today is the measuring day.
You're down four.
The excess, yeah. The excess negative.
That's where that comes into play.
Right. You don't lose what is equal to the downside protection. So you've got this 10% buffer. So if the market goes down like it has, from measuring point to measuring point, we start. You're in the negative game.
What I like about this is the fact that, you know, we brought up this before, where you have 100,000 in the market, and if you lose 50%, what's the easiest math to do this on?
Well, if you lose 25%, it takes a 33% return to get back to even because of the way that math works. So in this one, if you lose 14%, it takes about 17% to get back to even if you're just using simple return numbers. And so the downside hurts quite a bit more than the upside can help in some respects. So if I've got that $100,000 and the market's down 14% and I'm only down 4, I only have to make up about 4.5 to get back to even, whereas the market's got to make 17.
Exactly. So you got two people. You got one who put 100 grand, identical investments in equities, and it follows whatever index. The index is down 14%. My buddy's only got 86,000.
Right.
I've got 96,000.
A 10% difference. Go figure.
Yeah, amazing.
10% buffer on that particular hypothetical issue.
Right, and the best thing about this is that you don't have to get now, you know, the 20-something percent to make it up.
Right, you just have to, you know. And when we're looking at these types of products, we're looking at the upside potential. Now, if the caps are about the same as the fixed index annuities, they don't make sense because the upside isn't that much greater, if anything, than the upside of a fixed index annuity. But I have some downside on this where the downside on the fixed index annuity is zero.
So even if the market lost 30%,
you've lost zero on the fixed index. But as the caps, as the spread between the two of them gets bigger, where the cap on a fixed index annuity may be 4.5 to 5, but the cap on a structured note may be 10, okay, now am I willing to take that other side? And at some point, and that's why it is not a guaranteed investment. And they typically, when you're buying them individually, I don't like them as so much as when there are annuity products that package it all up. But the reason that the annuity products make sense is that they're buying millions of dollars at a time, whereas you and I are buying a $20,000 note at a time.
Right.
Their pricing is a lot better than our pricing. Now, because it's an annuity chassis, there is a surrender charge for a period of years. That's why it should be an intermediate term investment in the first place. Typically, the surrender charge lasts for 5, 6, 7 years. Depends on the company issuing the contract. Now, the advantage, what most people are saying, oh, it's an annuity, he's going to talk about fees. Yeah, I'm going to talk about fees. If all you're using are the structured portion of this inside those annuities, there aren't any fees, at least in the ones I've seen. Now, there may be an odd one out there I haven't seen that has fees, but the ones I've seen, there are no additional fees for the annuity, so it doesn't cost you anything to get into it. You just have better pricing because you're going in with, you know, 10,000, 100,000 of your best friends to pool your money to buy these structured notes and structured products.
Okay, so I guess the question would be, if somebody's going to put money into equities, they're going to do an index, something like that, why would they not want to have this, I hesitate to call it insurance, but in some ways it
buffer.
Is.
Just
why
call it
would
buffer.
They not want to have this buffer? What is it because if the market goes up 40%, they want to take the chance and be able to participate in all 40% and not be capped?
Yeah, and they want the ability to maybe move and shake and groove a little bit quicker. They want the ability, so it's time horizon driven to me. Over a 15, 20, 25 year period of time, I can accept the risk and the potential upside return of the true market diversified portfolio. Over a 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 year, 10 year period of time, I don't want to accept the pure risk of the market. That's too aggressive. So I'm going to temper that risk and still try to get a reasonable, not the same as the market, a reasonable, hopefully, rate of return. Now, obviously, if the market goes down 20% this year, 20% next year, 20% the following year, 20% the following year, 20% the following year.
Well, you got...
serious problems everywhere. But you've lost money in your investment, but not as much as the economy's hurting.
No, that's true. I like to know kind of worst case scenario, or as best as I can get to it.
And typically in these types of products, you've got different tranches, different sleeves, whatever you want to call it. You can do 10% buffers, 20%, 30%, or some other. Some have 15s and 25s. Mm-hmm. You can do one-year time segments, two-year, three-year, four-year, five-year time segments. You can do S&P. You can do Russell. You can do international.
Oh, any number.
If one of them's down a lot, maybe you can. And every time period, you can switch as long as you stay within the annuity for the surrender charge period.
These are structured notes we're talking about?
Structured notes, yeah.
Okay, all right. If you have questions on any of this, we're here to talk to you about it. 877-PLANNER, PLANNER. Johnny Dean, Professor Rick Plum. It is Bucket Strategy Investing. Bucket Strategy Investing. Johnny Dean, Professor Rick Plum here answering your questions. And we'll get some more of your emails in just a second. And again, speaking of answering your questions, we can do so in person. And if you're within the sound of our voice or watching us or anywhere, I would say, there's a pretty good chance that we're going to be near where you happen to be. If you'd like to know where the Brain Trust is going to be hanging out, you go to wealthed.com, our website, wealthed.com. Look at it. Find out where we're going to be. You can sign up for any of the workshops that we have remaining in the spring 2016 Lucia Capital Group Retirement Income Strategies Workshop Series. We do this in the spring. We also do this in the fall leave the summers alone because a lot of our locations happen to be in the desert. Also, some of our locations during the winter happen to be in some very cold places. But anyway, go to wealthed.com. If you have any questions on any of this stuff, you can just give us a call. You can call the off-air number, too, 800-644-1150. All the workshops are free, and they're all worth, they're worth the price. That doesn't sound right. They're worth more than what you pay for, which is nothing. Okay, and wealthed.com, our website, you can send us an email. I had two from Sherry in Levine, Arizona. And so I read the other one in a previous hour. This is the second one. Sherry says, around 2006, I formed a revocable living trust with my husband after my parents told me I, quote, needed one to protect our home, etc. I finally got permission from my mortgage company to list our home in the trust, but do I still need to do this? I know it will keep our home out of probate, so if that's so important, what else should I list in our trust? our 1969 Mach 1, my husband restored by himself.
Nice.
What is that? That's a...
It's a Mustang.
Mustang.
It's okay. A very nice Mustang.
My 2005 Dodge, my jewelry, my silver coins. So the question is, do I still need a living trust? And if so, what should I list in it and who helps me to do that? A title company? Thanks. Again, that's Sherry in Levine, AZ.
Well, when your parents told you that you needed one to protect your assets, I'm not sure what they were trying to protect it from other than probate. I mean, the whole reason is probate. It doesn't protect you from liability. It doesn't protect you from lawsuits. So from that standpoint, the living trust doesn't help. But it does help make probate, not for you, obviously, because probate doesn't kick in for you until you're gone. It helps make probate a lot easier for your heirs. And what you would want to do, since you have it, assuming it's done and it's a good trust, put your house in it, yes. Change the title. You can have a trust company help you with that if you want. They're very good at that. But you would also want to own any other major asset that is not an IRA or 401k or a retirement account. So your brokerage accounts, if you have any, CDs, bank accounts, maybe your day-to-day checking you leave out because you don't keep that much money in it. Now, when it comes to cars, it's a different game because an expensive car that's a collector's item that you're going to keep forever and you want to pass on, yeah, I'd put the title in the name of the trust. A car that's your daily runabout that's not worth all that much money that they're just going to blow out and sell, you're probably going to sell many times before you pass away. And that one's not as important because it probably won't last. The car won't last as long as you do. So you're just going to end up selling it later anyway. But a collector car I would put in. Now, when it comes to things like jewelry, you don't have a title on jewelry. If you have a title on jewelry, put it in the trust. Whatever you can put on a title, put it in the living trust. IRAs are separate issues. 401ks and things like that are separate issues. But a lot of the personal items, your furniture, you know, there's no title to it. So that doesn't go in the trust. It's only things that you can actually put on title.
As a registered owner, somebody who officially owns this kind of thing.
Now, if you own the Hope Diamond, you know, if it has a registration on it that shows you the owner of the Hope Diamond, then, yeah, that'd be in the trust.
Well, sure, yeah. Now, the reason that things like 401ks and IRAs don't have to be in the trust is because they have beneficiary designations, or they're supposed to have them.
Right, and so you want to coordinate the beneficiary title, the beneficiary assignments of your life insurance, your annuities, your 401ks, IRAs, TSAs, whatever the type of retirement account you have. If you, and we've talked about this earlier in the show, if management of that money after you're gone is a concern, then you can name the beneficiary the trust. Now, be very careful when you're dealing with surviving spouses. Surviving spouses should be the primary beneficiary, and only if you have some wonderfully high-end estate planning would you name the living trust, the revocable living trust between spouses as the beneficiary instead of the surviving spouse. That causes all kinds of problems. So it's only for non-spouse beneficiaries that you want to control the money for. You can name them directly, no control, or you can name the trust, assuming it's got the right language in it, and that will control it for those beneficiaries. Spousal beneficiaries are a problem unless you've got some very high-end estate planning issues.
And the reason being?
There's no tax deferral. You know, how long, and usually that's when the IRAs and other tax deferred accounts are the largest, and you know that they're going to be. And unless the trust becomes irrevocable when you die, doesn't qualify for stretching out the IRA or for transferring it to the surviving spouse as a spousal beneficiary. And most living trusts have two components to it, at best, maybe three, where part of it becomes irrevocable, but the other part doesn't. And because there's a portion of it that doesn't, it screws up the taxation. I mean, you're going to have either a 1 or a 5 year distribution on that IRA if you do it wrong. And most people that set it up that way, we're talking about spouses, are going to do it wrong unless they have some significant help with high-end estate planning work. So from your standpoint, it doesn't sound like you've done that. You've got a basic trust, which is fine. It's going to avoid probate. Perfect. It's what it was designed to do. It's going to work well. Just have somebody review it and make sure that it's doing everything you want every once in a while, that you know your beneficiaries are who you want it to be, the handcuffs are there or not there the way you want them to be, and that everything's titled correctly.
Stuff that you mentioned that doesn't have a title, you know, your furniture, your jewelry, and all this other stuff, I mean, all that has to somehow be accounted for.
Right.
But you can't go down, how do you go down through everything you own? Obviously, you're not going to do that.
You can. I mean, there are ways, I think, that you can make a list of everything that should be owned by the trust. You know, there's a schedule. And say, well, the furniture, the, you know, the Ethan Allen, you know, this, that, or the Thomasville, that. I mean, furniture's not my strong point. So
okay, whatever. I get it. Yeah.
You can probably put a list of everything that's on there. Most of the time, it just, you know, the furniture is not the expensive part of the estate. I mean, some houses, some places obviously are.
No, but if you're leaving it out and you're
it goes through the will.
They just
it's part of the probate estate.
Okay, so whatever, if you don't care where it goes, let them find it out.
Or put it in the will that if you want, you know, grandmother's rocking chair to go to your oldest daughter, your oldest son, whatever the case may be, it's in your will that says this is where it goes. And the will is very good at handing out personal items specifically. These are your wishes and they want to happen. And usually those personal items are not the more expensive items.
Right.
Usually. Now, if you've got very expensive personal items, you may want to talk to an attorney to figure out how to make it work. But most states, I think all states, but I can't say for sure, have a small estate affidavit that if your estate is under certain amounts of money, California is $100,000, it's not a huge probate process. It's still a process. It's still not the cheapest thing in the world, but it's not that much money because it's not a huge expense. Where you run into problems where you have the house. You know, the house in California may be worth $1 million, but you have an $800,000 mortgage against it. And so they're going to probate $1 million, not the $200,000 of equity.
No, and that's
$1 million.
And that's where the cost starts to really go up high, right?
Yeah, because you're paying a percent of the million, not
exactly.
of your equity.
So that's where it's where the trust can come in handy.
Oh, it comes in very handy.
Absolutely. One of the reasons you do that. Okay, we got more coming up. Somebody was asking about what we were talking about in a previous hour, a previous week actually, regarding spousal Social Security for ex-spouses and all that. So we'll try to clear that up. and more of your emails and phone calls. Lines open, 877-PLANNER. This is Buckett Strategy Investing. It is Buckett Strategy Investing. Johnny Dean, Professor Rick Plum are here for you and with you until the top of the hour. So get your questions in now. 877-PLANNER, P-L-A-N-N-E-R. We will answer some of these questions we had on what we were talking about before with regard to spousal Social Security and after divorce. And there are criteria that you need to know and need to be aware of. We'll run those down one more time for the people who are asking that. But let's get to a couple of calls. 877-PLANNER. P-L-A-N-N-E-R. Up next, Matt in Cypress, Texas. Hello, Matt.
Gentlemen, good afternoon to you.
Right back at you.
Actually, it's still morning for you.
Close.
Two questions for the professor. Professor, my aunt, who is 97 and a half, assisted living, that's where her room is, and we pay her rent on a monthly basis. I know that's not deductible for income tax, but here's my question. In December, she had problems with her legs and needed extra care from that facility to move her around, you know, bathe, breakfast, lunch, and dinner. Now, let's just say that was $900. Am I able to write that off as a medical expense on income tax, or can you tell me where to go, what publication?
I'd have to look up the publication number, but if you added this medical expense to all the other medical expenses that she has for the year,
yes,
what is it total up to?
Oh, I don't have it done yet. I'm doing my income tax now.
I mean, is it going to total up to $7,000, $8,000?
Well, with I'm claiming her also as a dependent exemption. So between my wife, myself, and her, it'll be more than, you know, 7.5% of my medical expenses for all three of us.
7.5% of your adjusted gross income.
Correct.
And then when you add that excess over 7.5%, now are you 65?
66.
Okay, well, that's so we just need the 7.5% figure. Are you going to itemize your deductions?
Correct.
Okay. I'd have to look up the exact publication number. It's in the 900 range. Typically, things that are convalescent in nature are not deductible. They have to be medical necessity in nature, medically necessary to be deductible. So I'd have to look up for sure. But if you want to stick around until the next break, I'll try to find the deduction, the medical publication that shows exactly what it is. But I don't think, you know, somebody coming in to help you care for your household and just caring for yourself, but there's something nagging at the back of my head that I'm trying to remember what I read on this. I don't think it is right off the top of my head, but I'm not anywhere.
You're not going to go out on a limb and say
that. I'm not even going to say 99% sure on this one. I'm in the 70-30 camp right now. I'll have to look it up.
Sir, I am off the air. I listen to you tomorrow from noon Central Time. Do you think you can mention it then?
It'd be better to hold on for a minute and so we can get your phone number and I'll try to call you back.
All right, one more question.
Sure.
Yeah.
If the Almighty takes my aunt, who is starting to fail this year, anytime this year, and please don't think I'm insensitive, but if the Almighty takes her this year, do I get the full dependent exemption for her, or is it considered prorated?
I think you get the whole one. I don't believe there's any proration to the dependent expense. I mean, I know that if a married couple, if one of them dies January 2nd, they're still married for the entire year. The surviving spouse gets to file as a married, filing a joint return, gets to take them as a full deduction for the whole year, exemption for the whole year. I don't believe there's any exempt or any proration of the exemption. You either get it or you don't.
Okie dokie. I'll hold to see if the first question you can answer for me, if
sure.
You'd be so kind.
You bet. Hold on, Matt, and we'll get your number, and we'll have Professor Plum. You might be able to look it up during the break. I'm not sure, but we can talk about it. But it might be better, as you said, for you to give him a call, or he'll give you a call off the air.
I was wrong on the 900 number. It's publication 502.
Well, you got that already. All right. Well, 502. Now, the question, of course, is...
convalescent care.
Yeah, and that's always a kind of a weird sticking point, I think, because things like Medicare don't cover convalescent care. The question is, what is deductible, I guess? And we'll find out. All right. 877-PLANNER, our number, PLANNER, 877-752-6637. We do have some email, we do have some lines, some phone lines open. I got an email on this. It was kind of lengthy, but I'll shorten it and just nutshell it for you, which had to do with our discussion sometime last week, Professor Plum, regarding Social Security after divorce. And what they want to know is, can you please go over the criteria that are used for determining whether or not you can get a benefit, a Social Security benefit, from an ex-spouse? And near as I can tell, there are about 7 or 8 different things that need to be done.
But a couple of key ones. One is the marriage had to last for at least 10 years. It had to be 120 months in duration or more to be eligible for any kind of ex-spouse's benefits, whether it's a ex-spouse that died later, not while you were married, whether it's an ex-spouse and you want to take a retirement benefit from them. So the first thing is the marriage had to have lasted for at least 10 years. Now, if you're not currently receiving a benefit from that work, from that worker's record, the divorce has to be at least 2 years.
You have to have been divorced for at least two years.
Yeah. Now, those are the main ones. The third one is you got to be single.
Well, that's true. Now when you say if you already were receiving it and you're divorced, they're not going to make you stop and make you be divorced.
No, if you get if you're receiving a spousal benefit and then you get divorced, you can continue to receive that spousal benefit. But if you are not receiving the benefit and you get divorced, there's a 2-year waiting period.
Right.
Now, or the ex-spouse has to apply for their own benefit. It's one of those things that they were trying to get rid of the restricted application. I mean, it was just a game where people were getting divorced so they could become eligible for a spousal benefit that they weren't eligible for when they were married, because the worker had not applied for their benefit. And there's no requirement for an ex-spouse to have applied for the benefit, just they have to be eligible to apply. So people would get divorced without, so they could get a benefit that they weren't otherwise eligible for. So they put in a 2-year waiting period for that.
Were they really getting divorced just for that?
That's what they feared. I don't know how many people actually went through it, but it gave the ability to get a divorce. I'm 62 years old, husband and wife, both 62. Husband in this case is going to keep working until 66. Spouse wants a spousal benefit at 62 because they never worked or had a very small one, mm-hmm. whatever the case may be. As a current spouse, the non-working spouse can't apply for a spousal benefit until the worker actually applies. They're going to keep working until 66. They can't apply until 66. But if they got divorced, assuming this 2-year rule wasn't in there, ex-non-working spouse could apply right then, get a benefit, even though the worker is still working and mm-hmm. not taking their benefit. So they put this 2-year rule in.
Now, okay, so the criteria. You have to be married for at least 10 years.
Yep.
You have to have been, if you're not already getting a benefit, you have to have been divorced for at least 2 years.
Yes.
You need to be
single.
That's a big.
Those are the three biggies.
Well, another one is you have to be at least 62. Nothing's going to happen if you're not old enough to take your Social Security.
Again, you're not going to be eligible for something that you wouldn't have been eligible for when you were married.
Right, and your ex must be at least age 62. And, well, okay.
They don't have to be receiving a benefit.
They don't have to be receiving a benefit. They don't even have to have applied.
They just have to be eligible. You can't.
Now,
as an ex-spouse, you're not going to be eligible for something that you wouldn't have been eligible for as a current spouse.
Right.
And if you're trying to get a spousal benefit and your current spouse is under 62, you're not eligible for a benefit anyway, current
exactly.
spouse or ex-spouse.
Now, here's the other thing too. You also need to apply for your own benefit if you're not full retirement age yet. First.
There's two categories in this. If you are at least 62 before the end of this year, you don't have a choice until your full retirement age. You still have to apply for your own benefit first. It's discounted. And then if the spousal benefit at that age is more, you can get an extra amount equal to the difference. Now, for anybody who is not 62 by the end of this year, that will always be the case. You will never be able to apply for a spousal benefit without applying for your own benefit first. If you were 62 before the end of this year, if you wait until your full retirement age, then you can choose. This is one of the aggressive claiming strategies
yes.
that they got rid of or are in the process of getting rid of as of last November. The file and suspend was one, and this one known as the restricted application is going away as well.
Right.
So and if you're 62 already, you still have that restricted application available to you unless you turned 62 in the last month or so. If you're not 62 already, you do not have the ability to ever do a restricted application. You will never be able to choose to take only the spousal benefit, leaving your own benefit to grow until 70.
Well, unless they change the laws, but the way they have the laws set up right now, no, you're not going to, and they're not going to change the laws. I understand that. Also, just like every other benefit, you are subject to the earned income
retirement earnings test.
Yes, if you're under full
it is potentially taxable based on all the same rules for any other benefit.
Exactly.
Everything else applies.
And if your ex decides at age 66 to suspend their benefit,
you could potentially be...
We don't know yet.
Messed up as well.
According to us, you will be messed up. All right, 877-PLANNER. We got more emails, phone calls, lines open. It is Bucket Strategy Investing. More from Professor Plum's collection of 45s.
This is actually in my CD rack of my car.
Oh, it is. All right. I thought maybe you'd have a big jukebox filled with, you know, Meatloaf songs and, you know, theme from Rocky Horror or something. I don't know. I have no idea. Anyway, Johnny Dean, Professor Plum here till the top of the hour, answering your money questions. We got some emails to get to. A couple of lines open right now. In fact, it looks like every line is open somehow. So if you want to give us a call, you can do so right now. 877-PLANNER is our number, PLANNER. Money questions asked and answered here and live in person. Professor Plum, he may even bring his record collection. I don't know. But you can meet the brain trusts, including Professor Plum, Terry Keyes, and the local advisors at one of the many 2016 Retirement Income Strategies workshops put on by Lucia Capital Group. Starting again February 20th, that's just, you know, not that far away, Las Vegas, Nevada, Saturday, February 20th in Las Vegas. You go to wealthed.com, W-E-A-L-T-H-E-D, wealthed.com. Sign up. It's all free. Saturday morning, February 20th in Las Vegas. Room in Seattle as well the following week, Saturday, February 27th. And then Phoenix, Arizona happens on March the 12th. Of course, notice the pattern. These are all Saturdays. That's right. And they're all around 9 o'clock local time starts. And we'll get you in and out of there as quickly as we can. But you're really going to want to stick around for the entire couple of hours because your chance to ask their questions, whatever money questions that you have, anything at all, that happens there toward the end of the show. So, check it out at wealthed.com. Sign up. It's all free. Wealthed.com. And meet the brain trust. That's kind of cool. All right. Got some trivia to get to. Another email or two. This one, we talked on last week, might have been Friday, had a similar trivia from the Internal Revenue Service. Taxpayers that reported less than $50,000 of adjusted gross income in tax year 2013. Paid 6% of all federal income tax that year at an effective tax rate of 11%. All right, now, Professor Plum, less than $50,000 of adjusted gross income. I mean, the average income is right around $50,000, I do believe.
Of people that actually file a return, yes.
Yes, yeah, the average income is right around $50,000. And yet they paid 6% of all federal income tax. Now, we saw last week that if they reported at least $1 million of adjusted gross income.
Which is the top point, about 0.1%.
Yeah, they paid 24% of all federal income tax. That's effective tax rate of 31%.
Now, when we... 11% effective tax rate on $50,000 sounds high to me.
Should be lower than that.
Well, I would imagine so, especially
for a married
couple. But, you know, I'm not going to argue with them, but
no.
Anyway.
We don't want to do that. Okay, so when we say an effective tax rate of 11%, what are we talking about here? Because someone would say, well, there is no 11% tax bracket. There's a reason for that.
On an adjusted gross income of $50,000, let's go through a single person. The first $6,300 of that $50,000 isn't taxed at all. Actually, the first $10,300 of it isn't taxed at all. So there's a 0% tax on that, on 20% of the money. The next $9,000 or so is taxed at 10%, and then the rest of it is taxed at a roughly 15% bracket. So on average, you take the 0, They take the 10, you take the 15. On average, they say you're paying 11% overall. It just seems higher than I would expect.
Yeah, it could be. But according to them, that's exactly what it was. We said we're not going to argue with the IRS. All right, 877-PLANNER. I said that, PLANNER, 877-752-6637. We got an email from, let's see here. You know what? Actually, let me take another call here before the top of the hour, because this email's a little bit long. I don't know if we can get to it in time. So, John in Richmond, Michigan, I believe it was, we'll get your email. Just hold tight. It may have to be on another program. But let's move to Jimmy up next in Las Vegas with a question. Hi, Jimmy.
Hey, fellas. Great show as always. Been listening to you all for years and call in every now and then.
Thank you.
So, It seems recently in my circle of friends in the financial services industry, I've been approached with buying, investing in IUL, which I think is the Index Universal Life Insurance Policy.
Yeah, they're really popular right now.
Well, could you just kind of break it down for me? What is it in a nutshell, and why are they so popular? I mean, I'm getting hit by like four or five different people I know from four or five different companies that are just kind of like popping up out of the weeds, and I'm curious.
Well, first, it is a life insurance policy, so you kind of need life insurance. It is a cash value policy. It is, first and foremost, a universal life policy. With a universal life policy, you're putting in your premium dollars. Your premium dollars go into this, you know, pool of money, and each month, just like any other universal life, a little bit comes out of the bottom for the cost of the insurance, the cost of the contract, and things of that nature. Those are the mortality and expense charges that all insurance policies are going to have. And then whatever's still left in the pool, because those expenses may be $50 and you put in $100 or you know, some exaggerated number from that. So whatever's left in the pool earns interest. The interest on a typical universal life policy is stated in advance and is, you know, similar to an intermediate term bond return. So it's going to be in the 2-3% area right now. Some of the older ones are still paying 3 and 4 because that's the baseline. They can't pay less than that. But you have an interest bearing account. With an IUL, an indexed universal life, it still works the same way. It's just that the interest that's being credited is based on the performance of an index. The S&P 500, the Russell, the EFA, the Dow, a blended portfolio, whatever the case may be. So the idea is that hopefully, at least in today's world, you're getting a better, well, maybe not this week, and maybe not this month or this year so far, but in a days like we had in 13 and 14, the interest that was being paid on your reserve pool was a lot more than you could receive on any other type of universal life policy. And looking historically, where the market is up more years than it's down, and there's no downside, you can't lose cash value because of a bad market. Whereas, you know, with a variable policy or some type of investment that is fully exposed to the market, you can make money when the market goes up, but you can also lose money when the market goes down. This is an interest-bearing account. It either pays interest or it doesn't. So the only drain in the bad years is the mortality expenses that come out the bottom to pay for the life insurance itself. So they're very popular right now because they're being sold that you can't lose money. And look at the history that we've had, and the cap rates are significantly higher in life insurance than they are on annuities.
Hey, Jimmy, listen, I have to end the hour here. If you need some more information, you have some more questions, hold on a second. I'll have Professor Plum talk to you off the air here, because I know these things can get complicated. It's another good topic. We should bring that up on a first hour at some point. So hold on, Jimmy. If you need the brain trust off the air, you can talk to Professor Plum or any of the advisors across the country at their off-air number, Lucia Capital Group, 800-644-1150. For Professor Rick Plum, I'm Johnny Dean. This is Bucket Strategy Investing.
Information presented should not be considered specific tax, legal, or investment advice. You should always seek counsel of the appropriate advisor prior to making any investment decision. All investments are subject to risk, including the loss of principal. There is no guarantee that any investing or financial planning strategy will be profitable, provide protection from loss, or meet its stated objectives. Investment advisor representatives of Lucia Capital Group are also registered representatives of and offer securities through Lucia Securities, LLC, a registered broker-dealer, member FINRA, SIPC. John Dean is an associated person with Lucia Securities, LLC. In the information presented, the opinions and views expressed are subject to change without notice and may not come to pass. Registration with the SEC does not imply a certain level of skill or training.